Pacific Group is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh. And all members of the community are welcome to attend. The most important aspect of AA recovery, however, is the principle of one alcoholic relating to another alcoholic. Therefore, only alcoholics actually participate in our meeting. If your primary purpose is other than alcoholism, we think it would be also helpful to you to contact an anonymous organization that more specifically deals with your addiction. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Good evening. My name is Susan, and I am an alcoholic. Welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by a main speaker. Speakers, please note you will be given 5-minute and 1-minute reminders when it is time to wrap up your talk. Our first 10-minute speaker is Patty G.
I am Patty. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Marty, for asking me to speak tonight. It definitely is an honor and a privilege. It's crazy. It's on Zoom. My sobriety date is March 19, 2012. Hilda F. is my sponsor. 12-pack, that's right, daily. I see you. And Pacific Group is my home group. And if you're new tonight, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous, to the Pacific Group. I love this group. And AA has definitely changed the person that I am. I came in here completely broken, angry, suicidal, and I turned into what I feel like a lovely person compared to what I used to be. You know, it miracles can happen here. This is true. I've seen it. You know, look around this room. You'll see many miracles here. So the first time I took a drink, I was 10 years old that I could remember. I was at my mom's 40th birthday party, and it was huge, you know. So we lived in Inglewood, and my parents had separated. I have two older sisters. I had a stepdad at that time, and there was just a huge party. Everybody on the block came. It was super exciting, and I love the sound of music. I love the smell of alcohol before I even tasted it. I just thought that drinking just was something that adults do, and that's what fun looks like. And I wanted a part of that, you know. So me and my middle sister, we went to the cooler and we grabbed a couple wine coolers. It looked like fruit punch, looked innocent. So we grabbed a couple of those and we went to the front of the building into this little nook where the garage was. And we drank those wine coolers and we smoked this beady. It looked like a joint, but it wasn't a joint, but it looked like a joint. So I thought I was getting some effect from it, but it was just nicotine. and I remember just thinking I wanted to go back to that cooler. And that's just the way it looks. You know, and I'll say it time and time again, I'm never going to be that type of drinker that goes to happy hour and drinks a couple drinks and says, oh, you know what, I got to wake up in the morning. You know, I don't know what it's like to drink responsibly, like those ads say. I know how to guzzle. I know how to take shots. I know how to, you know, throw up, get a second wind, or throw up and drink until I pass out. That's how I like to drink. And I don't know what it's like to be a social drinker. I don't, you know, I thought social drinking meant that you're drinking with another person. I didn't even know what that really meant. And I didn't know that I was an alcoholic, but anytime I could get my little hands on something, I was doing it. And I didn't become an everyday drinker at like 10 years old or anything like that. But, you know, I started drinking and one of the things that happened was I was violated by a neighbor next door and I got my first resentment. And time passed, you know, and I'm a teenager and my dad picks me up and tells me that he's going to leave and he's moving to Switzerland and he's not coming back. And I remember just having another resentment that would lead me to drink for years on end, because I had this huge resentment against him. I thought that I wasn't worth anything. And I carried that into sobriety. But, you know, thank God for the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a relationship with my father now, which I thought I would never have. And so anybody out there who's having problems with their family, you think that maybe you can never reconcile things, like there is a chance, you know, if we just work the steps and just stay with this program. And so I go to college and I just become like the party girl. I love to party. I love to drink. I love to go to frat parties, love the jungle juice. And it was all fun going to Mexico, partying. Every song is my song, dancing on the table. It was just a lot of fun, you know, until it wasn't fun anymore. And I didn't know when I crossed that line. I don't know if I ever, if there ever was a line, to be honest, but I know that I became a very violent person. And I blacked out. I used to think that I was just losing time until I came to you guys and found out what a blackout was. And I would black out and get violent and hit people and break furniture and put holes in the walls and threaten people's lives. And, you know, maybe on a good night, I was a little bit on the promiscuous side and I like your boyfriend and he's mine for the night. And I had no shame. And I went to Catholic school my whole entire life and all those values and God and everything that was good had just disappeared. I didn't believe in it anymore because I thought I was going to burn in hell. So that God wasn't for me anymore. And I'm in college and graduate by the skin of my teeth, you guys, the skin of my teeth, like I barely graduated. And I remember graduating, getting this job and helping the Department of Children and Family Services and probation youth. And I was taking them to rehabs and meetings like this. And I was living a complete double life because every time I would go home, I'd stop at the Food for Less, get two bottles of wine, and I would look for ways to commit suicide every single day because my life became smaller and smaller and I could not be around people and I could not stop thinking about drinking. And I would get that relief inside of me before I even had my hands on the bottle, just knowing that I was going to get it. And, you know, I remember drinking the red wine because the red wine was going to help me so I didn't get cancer. But I was obsessively thinking about death and I was looking up cyanide poisoning in different ways to look like I had a natural death. And I was looking through the blinds and everything, but it was like, did I want to live? Did I want to die? Like, what was the deal? I didn't know. But, you know, the last night of drinking, I barely had any friends left. Everybody was like, you're just a wreck, you know? And I can't be around you when you drink. And the fact is, I don't want to be around you if I'm not drunk. So I didn't know, you know, what was I going to do? So I was pretty much down to a couple friends. And one of my last friends that I went out with was on March 17th, 2012, St. Patty's Day. I was like, yes, St. Patty's Day is my day. We drink. Next thing I know, I'm back in LA. I'm back in the valley from LA. And I come to water hitting me. And there's just this water flying all over the place. And I had hit a fire hydrant, crashed the fire hydrant, didn't know that I was driving the car. And I start trudging the road of happy destiny to my house and realize that my purse is in the car. I'm like, oh, well. So I went to jail that night and I got out and I admitted to my mom and my sister that I was an alcoholic, a drug addict, and I wanted to kill myself on a daily basis. And I knew what I had to do. I knew I was going to have to come to you guys because a friend of mine had a DUI in the past. And I knew it was going to have to happen. And I was going to have to go sit around in the circle with the old men with the trench coats, all depressed. And that's what I was going to have to do. And I was like, okay, you know. And I came to you guys again. My sobriety day is March 19, 2012. I came to you guys a couple days later. And, you know, so I didn't leave. You know, I didn't get a sponsor right away. So if you're new, get a sponsor. I didn't get a sponsor for 30 days. I looked at those steps. I was not like trying to admit anything or apologize to anybody because they deserved it. And I was completely wrong. You know, I got a sponsor. She was the meanest woman in the room. God bless her. And she laid down a foundation that has helped me ever since. And, you know, things have been interesting in sobriety. It's not been like a bed of roses or anything. There's been challenges. I had lost that job, lost my job during COVID. Things have been, you know, a lot of changes have come, but all good changes. You know, a lot of pain that I've put myself through has launched me into a course of action to change and become a better person and to be more useful to everybody, to anybody I could get in contact with, you know. And, when troubles came up with trauma from the past, I started to go to therapy and that seems to help. And, you know, with the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, my sponsor, thank God for my sponsor, because she just keeps it real with me. And, you know, and she's always asking me, where's God in it? You know, and now I have this God in my life that's just so amazing and so big. And I know that I can rely on him to carry everything that I have on my shoulders. I don't have to carry it all on me. I could put it on him and like just pray for the best and hope for the best. And usually I just get what God is giving to me, not what I want. It's what he sees fit. And sometimes it's kind of hard. It's kind of a hard pill to swallow, I'm not going to lie, but it's good. You know, I have a good life and I have a good relations with my family. Me and my dad we have a great relationship. I have a great relationship with my niece and my nephews, who they didn't really know me because I was a crazy drunk who was just eating lunch or breakfast for lunch. That's how they remembered me. And now I'm their favorite aunt and it's a miracle, you know. And I've been able to be of service in this group, which has kept me busy during COVID. And I'm so grateful for that and grateful for these meetings. All the people who have just like shined throughout this time, all the people that have helped and had these meetings right away. We didn't skip a beat, and that is just like a miracle and a testament of how good our group is, you know? And I really appreciate you again, Marty, for asking me to do this. I told him in the green room that he made me do it, but I really do appreciate it. And I'm glad that you, you know, you paid a 12-step call on me. So thank you guys. Good night. Stay safe.
Thank you, Patty. Our second 10-minute speaker is Ron W.
Thank you, Susan. Ron, alcoholic. Marty, thank you for asking me to do this. I love you, man. There, instead of all the things I wanted to say to you when you asked, I love you. It's weird because I was complaining to a couple old timers, like, you know, I got sober December 15th of 97. I was 19. I'm 42 now. So it's 23 years. And I was complaining to a couple old timers, like, how come I never get asked to speak? Blah, blah, blah. And then literally 4 days later, Marty asked, I'm like, yeah, I don't want to do it. It's just how I am. It's like, I want what I don't have. And then when you give it to me, I'm like, all right, that was cool, you know, but I just thought it's because my story sucks. That's why I don't talk much, or I don't have anything good to say. But thank you, Patty, for sharing, because I'm like, yeah, I relate. I get it. You know, I grew up in like a normal, average, dysfunctional, broken, violent home. You know, it's pretty average for all the stories that I've heard in here. And so that's helped a lot, you know, because I thought I was the only one. I was unique. I felt growing up, I felt this isolation, this aloneness, this, I mean, the book says irritable, restless, discontent. I also want to add loneliness, isolated, different, alien. Like I just didn't fit on this earth as far back as I can remember. You know, I didn't get well, I didn't get along in preschool. You know, I was biting people. That was my form of playing with you, was biting you. You know, like you take my Lincoln Logs, I take a chunk out of your arm, you know. That's just, I needed a drink. I grew up in a Southern family. I had beer in the baby bottle. There was whiskey on the pacifier. I don't know. I mean, there was always alcohol around me and it was always going in me. But the first beer I remember actually having was when I was 8 and I was with Dad and we were working on the truck and I was small enough to fit into the engine. And so I hopped in and fixed something for him. He handed me his beer and I drank it. And, I didn't like the fuzz. It was a Budweiser. I mean, it was like old school 80s Budweiser. And, you know, it foamed up in my nose and I gacked a little bit. And about halfway through that can, I did not feel alien or isolated or alone or irritable or restless. And I didn't know, oh, it's a beverage. It's a thing. I just, you know, I thought it was hanging with Dad and being productive. It wasn't until I got to high school, you know, where I was able to put two and two together that alcohol equals happy. Like I just couldn't figure that out. So I'm not the smartest tool. It took me 8 years to figure that out. And I was playing baseball. I'd already tried out for the minors by 16. I was like destined to have this great life and I didn't want any part of it, you know? And so I went to a baseball party and I drank. And the first social drink I had was Strawberry Hills Boone's Farm, the sparkly Kool-Aid. I didn't like it, so I just cut it with Mountain Dew because that was my beverage of choice at the time. Get me hyped, get me energized. And I drank the whole thing. And the weird part was I didn't want to go to the party. I didn't want to go and be around people. I hated my baseball team. You know, I hated everybody at that point. I was just afraid of you guys. Like looking back, I was afraid. I thought I just hated you because you're either better or worse. You're better looking than me, worse looking than me. You know, I was just never right here with people. But by the time I got through that bottle, I felt a part of. And then about 20 minutes after I got through that bottle, I realized that everybody at this party was stupid and a loser and beneath me. And why am I here wasting my time with all these PNs? You know, I'm just going to be a rich baseball player and I'm never going to see these jackasses again. So I left and drove drunk. And, you know, I think in the green room before they're requesting Freebird, that was my first drunk song, was Freebird. Because the version I listened to was 14 minutes and I lived 14 minutes from home. So from the party to my house, I got the full song. That was the best drive I ever took drunk, and I was 16. I got sober 3 years later, and that was after 3 years of just absolutely destroying my life, my body, my brain. All my relationships, baseball was gone. I dislocated both my shoulders in bar fights, jumping off of roofs of my girlfriend's houses to get away from their parents, busted up my knees. Plenty of, you know, just stupid stuff, car wrecks. I was arrested at Beach Week. Like, I don't know if they do that on the West Coast, but I grew up on the East Coast. So you go to beach after you graduate, you go to the beach for a week. And I lasted 3 days before I got arrested and kicked out of the state of Maryland for assaulting an officer. That was fun. And that was kind of the beginning of where I am now, because when that happened, you know, I went to college. I got arrested again when I went to college. And so I had a record, and they put me in this treatment thing for 30 days and said they'd kick me out if I didn't stay sober for 30 days. And I survived 30 days by using drugs. That's the only way I could survive not drinking, was using drugs. And so after the 30 days, I was back to drinking, drugs, baseball, and failing out of school. And by the time I was 19 years and 2 months sober, I was locked up in a psych ward. They locked me up. I had lost my mind. The doctor said I had a stroke because I'd been partying too long and taking too much substances. I think it was just God hitting me with a spiritual brick. You know, it was just like, hey man, you're getting ready to go down hard. And that's where I found you. You know, Julie Massaro was my doctor. She was a normie, and she told me about you guys. And I didn't know what to think, because I didn't know about AA. You know, there was one episode of The Simpsons where Barney had to get sober and went to a meeting or something like that, but I didn't really understand what that meant. So my first meeting I went to was the Glade Room in Reston, Virginia, on a Sunday night. And there must have been 45 people there under the age of 30. It was a young person's meeting. I'd walked right into like the Northern Virginia mecca of young people. And I was 19, and it was just like, I thought it was a party. I thought there was a keg somewhere. Something didn't make sense. Why are all these young people, you know, laughing, holding hands, hugging? I'm sweating. I got my hat pulled down over my eyes, you know. I didn't even have a winter jacket, and there's snow on the ground. Like, I was just a mess. But, you know, this big redheaded redneck came running out after me and said, keep coming back. And that's all I heard that whole meeting, besides, you know, Charlie Brown's teacher. And that's kind of what my sobriety's been about, is keep coming back. I don't, you know, my first sponsor was heavy on that. I don't care what you think. I don't care how you feel. Just take the action. Keep going to meetings. You don't like the people at the meeting? Go to the meeting. You like the people at the meeting? Go to the meeting. You don't have a job? You got a job. You know, he never cared. He's like, take the action or don't call me. And so I had good sponsorship, even though that guy was crazy. Like, that guy's certifiable, but he helped me get sober. And after 7 years of sobriety, working the steps, something happened. I guess I started wanting to live life. That was the gift you guys gave me. Was it Scott? Scott L, I think, was like, his main reason, he said one of his spiritual awakenings was he realized God got him sober to find out who he was meant to be before he started drinking. And I was like, that's an interesting concept. Like, what am I made of? You know, I'm an alcoholic through and through, but what else can I do? Like, I know I can drink. I know I can screw up. What else can I do? So I started going back to school and figured that out. And that's when I moved to the West Coast, because I wanted to see how creative I could get. I wanted to see what kind of man I could be, if I could live on my own, if I could be responsible and start taking on, you know, bills. Like, I lived at mom's house till I was 26. Like, I didn't pay a single bill. Like, I was a mooch. And, so I moved out, and that's where I met you guys. My grand sponsor at the time was Frank Jones, and that guy took me under his wing and just showed me the ropes around there. And again, strong. He's like, I don't care how you feel. I don't care what you think. Take the action. Show up to the meetings. Get a commitment. And what's happened in doing that is I found a God. I didn't know when I was drinking in all those times before, with all the like search for attention and pity and all that stuff, I was actually looking for a higher power. That's all I've been looking for my whole life, is something greater than me, because all these voices in here, they never agree on nothing, like nothing, except that I'm a piece of crap. They agree on that. So I've been looking for something to fill, to shut this up and fill whatever that hole is inside. And taking the actions around here, regardless of how I feel and what I think, has given me something greater than me. And it used to be the meetings, it used to be AA, you know, and the sponsors and all that. And now it's kind of gotten bigger than that, where intuition, it's basically what the Ninth Step Promises talk about. I intuitively know how to handle certain things. You know, my emotional stability has come about. You know, I've learned to meditate. You know, I'm sitting here looking at one of my favorite old timers. Hi, Cindy. So you're awesome. And I've just had so many good people around here guiding me in my experience, because it's not like any of us know what the hell to do. You know, we just kind of follow each other like lemmings, and it seems to work, especially even right now in this COVID thing. We're all on Zoom. This is fantastic. 982 people doing the same thing right now, so we don't drink together. I mean, I didn't want to do it. I didn't feel like doing this, but I'm here. So, you know, if you're new, don't worry about what you're thinking. Don't worry about how you're feeling. Just give yourself a break and let somebody else guide you. It really is the easier, softer way. Thank you.
Our main speaker tonight is Russell B.
Hey, hello, PG. I am Russell B, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm grateful to be here today. I'm grateful to be sober and to be a part of this wonderful program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And most of all, I'm grateful to be back at PG. See all these familiar faces. Hello, hello, hello. Greetings from Costa Rica. It's been a long time. PG is where it all began for me. This is I often say that everything I learned about life, I learned in AA, and most of that I learned in PG. I first walked into a Ohio Street meeting in September of 2000, and life changed after that. You know, PG is always my home. My sobriety date is September 2nd, 2000. My sponsor is Keith P., who is maybe somewhere out there in the PG video land there. And my home group is the Zoo Group here in Costa Rica. And I want to thank PG. I love this meeting. I mean, this is Zoom, but you guys, PG still has it together, you know. Tim is still banging the gavel, and there was that so organized. There was a Piper welcome to me in the green room. Thanks for that. There's a newcomer liaisons and out-of-town liaisons. I love it. PG has taught me so much about take things seriously, you know, take life seriously, live life seriously, live it fun. Amazing. So anyway, I'm a drunk driver from LA. I moved to LA to be a movie star. I went to a big university and I studied biology. But as it was time to graduate, I realized I didn't know any famous biologists. And so that really wasn't going to work for me, because I had real delusions of grandeur. You know, I needed something more than that. And in college, I did a few plays, and one of my professors said, "Wow, you're really good." And so I just took that in my mind and thought, I'm going to be a star. And I moved to LA. I knew that it was just going to be a little while before I was going to have my own TV show. So I moved to LA and I did what all artists do in LA. I became a waiter and I got a job at the spaghetti factory up on Hollywood Boulevard. And I was not a good waiter because I didn't really care about what kind of salad you wanted. I didn't really care about what kind of, you know, spaghetti you wanted. I was a movie star, and you may not know that, but it was going to happen for me. Waiting tables is a great job for a budding alcoholic, because every night I ended my job and I had money in my pocket and I had lots of people who were ready to drink with me, you know, and And so we would sit in the back of the spaghetti factory and we'd buy a 40, and some guy would roll a joint when they put some crack in the joint, and they called this a pee dog, you know? And so I'd smoke this pee dog and drink my 40. And I tell you, when I came into AA, Don L. spoke, and he said that drinking gave him hope. And when I heard that, I related to that, because that's what it did for me. Every night when I drank after work, I was on top of the world. You know, I would sit there and drink my 40, and I would imagine myself talking to Jay Leno on The Tonight Show. This is my time frame, Jay Leno. A lot of you guys don't know that, but I would talk to, you know, tell Jay Leno, you know, about how I was struggling artist and all that. And I would feel so good. And tomorrow was another day. That's what I loved about drinking, because every night, tomorrow was another day. And so I would drink, I would get high, and I would drive. That's what we do in LA. We drink and we drive, and we drink and we drive. And I did that night after night after night. In one of my DUI programs, they had us kind of figure out, like, how often did you drink and drive? And for me, it got up to probably about 2,000 times. 2,000 times. And many of those times, I was blacked out. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know where I was going. A couple of times I came to and had to kind of read signs to figure out where I was, you know, like, oh my God, I'm in Anaheim. I've got to get home somehow. You know, I came to once with my tire blown out, and I had to pull over and fix my tire in a drunken haze. What happened, you know, they talked about an AA that, you know, it starts off fun, and then you got some fun with problems, and then all problems, you know. And for me, the problems began. I get pulled over for drunk driving. I got pulled over for doing something wrong. And I remember the, you know, first couple times I got pulled over, I passed, you know. I remember once I got pulled over, and it was a cop and a rookie cop, and he was going to show the rookie how to do a DUI test and stuff. And I had like 15 vodka cranberries, and I was wasted, but I nailed it. You know, I got boom, 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 boom. I did the walk. I did everything, and he couldn't do anything. You know, he couldn't, you know, get me for a DUI. So he gave me a ticket, and, you know, and of course a normal person might think, oh my God, I never want to experience that again. In my mind, I thought, I'm awesome at this. I rock. I can do this, you know? And I loved driving. I loved drinking. I loved getting high. I would drive around Hollywood, you know, late at night when everyone else was done, you know, the bar would close and everyone was done, but I wasn't, you know, and I'd keep driving, and I'd drive around, and I'd listen to the Chili Peppers, you know, and the city I live in, the city of angels, lonely as I am, you know, and just I loved it. I was on top of the world, you know, and tomorrow was another day. Tomorrow that phone call's coming. Tomorrow it's all going to change, you know, and that's what drinking was for me. Drinking and drugging was my life, my hope. And I got my first DUI in March of 98. I was sentenced by the judge to AA and to a DUI program. I thought it was rude, you know. I thought it just was a bad night. I didn't need to go to AA, but I went, you know. I went to 26th and Broadway. I remember seeing this house down there in Santa Monica and always wondering what these people were doing. And now, okay, it's an AA meeting. I'm going to go there. And I went there, and I got there like right as the meeting was starting. I sat in the back, you know, and they dimmed the lights, and there were speakers. And the speakers were hilarious. They were so funny. I remember one woman shared that she came to in a strange apartment, and it wasn't the first time for her. So she grabbed her clothes, you know, and she tried to sneak out of the apartment, and she got out to the pool area, and someone said, hey, and they knew her name. And it turned out she had moved to that apartment like 2 weeks earlier, and she had been in a drunk, you know, blackout since then. And I was like, oh my God, you are insane. You know, AA is a great place for you people, because you're crazy and you belong here. I'm going to be okay. you know, I'm going to take this information and I'm going to go for it, you know? And that's what I did. I realized that drunk driving was a problem. So I would stop driving. You know, I had a friend who was also a drunk driver, and he got a couple DUIs. So he and I got together. We lived in Santa Monica, and we would walk to bars and we would take taxis, and everything was going to be fine until it wasn't. Until July of 99, I went to a friend's house. It was a Friday night. I went to a friend's house. We had some drinks and some pot, and they were going to a party that I wasn't invited to. So I rode my bike home, and it was 9 o'clock on a Friday, and I was high and I was drunk. I wasn't going to stay home. You know, I got in my car, I drove to a bar, I got drunk, I stayed out all night long. I was coming home, and I remember there was like this tow truck in the road, and it was kind of parked kitty corner, and I swerved to avoid it, and I heard this psh, and thought, well, I better check that when I get home, you know, and I kept driving, and these lights came behind me, and this car came up behind me and kind of cut me off, and the tow truck came up behind me and blocked me in, and the car that cut me off, the guy got out, and his arm was bleeding, and he was already on the phone. Cops were coming. I was busted for a felony hit and run. And I remember the next morning, my parents bailed me out of jail, and they drove me back to my little one bedroom apartment that I had there in Culver City. And they said to me, "What's wrong with you?" And I didn't have an answer. I didn't have an answer for them. I could not tell them what was wrong with me. I was going to do everything I could to control my drinking. You know, fortunately, my father, he got me a fancy Beverly Hills lawyer, and I got my reduced to a second DUI, and I had to go to LA County jail for 10 days. And, 10 days is a long time in LA County jail, but for me, it was plenty. I got in there. I was scared to death. You know, I didn't know what a peckerwood was, but that's what I was. You know, hey, Wood, what are you doing here? You know, and I just nothing. I'm just trying doing my time. And I remember sitting with these people, and this group of guys said, you know, I told them I was a teacher, and they're like, "Man, I would never have my kid in your class." And I remember thinking, "Do you see the irony in that?" But they didn't really see the irony in that. They didn't care. We got out of jail, and I was going to do everything I could to control my drinking. And I did for a year. I did marijuana maintenance, which just basically got my life smaller and smaller. I also did a thing where a friend of mine said he wasn't going to drink in the state where he lives. And I thought, wow, that could work, you know, because I went to New York that Christmas for a wedding, and I drank for a week. It was success. It turned out good. I went to Chicago for a wedding, and I drank there, and I came home. It was so successful that when I came home, I thought I could try another drink here, you know? And I remember I was at my parents' house, and they were helping them have a party. And I opened a beer, you know, and I was nursing this beer, you know? And if you ever tried to casually drink before, it's very hard because I didn't know how long between sips you're supposed to go if I'm casually drinking, you know? It's like sip, wait. And my parents, I remember they were driving me back to my house because I didn't have a license. I'd lost my license. And they were driving me back to my house, and they were in the front of the car, and I was in the back seat. And they both looked at me sort of in that rearview mirror, and they said, "We saw you drinking." You know, and I was like, again, I had nothing to say to them. You know, I didn't know what to say. I wanted to tell them how hard I was working and how hard it was, and I was trying my best. And, you know, the answer was, I wanted to drink. You know, I wanted to drink. And I white knuckled it probably until September of 2000. I white knuckled it. I had a kidney stone in September, and I went to the doctor, and the doctor gave me a bottle of Vicodin, and I popped one of the Vicodin, and at the same time, the stone passed, and the Vicodin felt great. And I was like, wow, this is good, you know? And I went home with this bottle of Vicodin, and it said best taken before the pain starts. Well, who knows when the pain's going to start, you know? So I started popping Vicodin and I looked at myself and thought, what do I do here? You know, I can't drink, I can't smoke pot. And now I've got to stop with this Vicodin. You know, that was a breaking point for me. I decided to try something that I'd heard in AA called 30 meetings in 30 days, you know? And before that I was like, who has time for 30 meetings in 30 days, you know? But I was going to try it. So I got my little directory, LA directory. And one Monday night I got lost. I couldn't find the meeting I was looking for. So I found this meeting on Ohio Street, you know, and I walked in there and it was different. It was a different kind of place. There was smiles, there was structure, there was people taking this seriously, like it was an important place to be. And I needed that. I needed a place that was important. Otherwise, why do it, you know? And in that meeting, I met a fellow actor. He was at the cookie table, you know, and I said, hey, and it was Tom B there. And I said, I met you at an audition. He's like, yeah. He didn't remember me, but he said, yeah. And he gave me his phone number and said, give me a call, you know? And so the first time I had someone that I could call and talk to, because we were colleagues, of course, you know? And so I called him that next day and I did that awkward first call. I was like, hey, it's me. I met you last night and you said, call you and blah, blah. And he said, hey, good. Let's meet again tonight at that same meeting, you know? So we met Tuesday night at Ohio Street. And he said, my first sponsor told me three things, three simple things. Get a sobriety date, get a sponsor, and get a home group. And if you have all three of those things and you hold on to them, you can stay sober, you know? And he made it that simple for me, because before this, it wasn't simple. You know, I was going to AA sometimes off and on, and I saw those 12, I saw them as rules on the wall, you know, and there was God all over the place. And I thought, this isn't going to work for me, but he made it simple, you know? And he also said, I want you to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And my first thought was who can do that? But I said, okay, you know, and that's, if you're new and you're desperate and you're willing just to say, okay, that's a great place to be. Cause that's where I was. I was like, okay, you know, and PG, I started going every day. And of course, eventually someone said, hey, do you have a job here? And I was like, I have a job, not here, but I have a job and I'm fine. Thank you very much. You know? And he said, no, you need a job here, you know, a little job that we do here. And so he gave me a job and I got a job at all seven of my meetings. And of course, they didn't tell you that, you know, the jobs last for a year. So suddenly I was committed to a year, you know, and those jobs, they saved me. I remember Friday night men's stag. I hated that meeting. I honestly did. I wasn't comfortable in that meeting, but I had to sweep up afterwards, you know, and there was a guy who was very judgmental who would pass out the brooms. And so if I didn't want to go to the meeting, I thought, I've got to go because otherwise he's going to say, I knew it. That guy's not coming back, you know? So I was going to go and show him and grab my broom. And I broomed, you know, I swept. And if you were still smoking and I'd already swept that area, I said, you swallow that butt because I've already swept this area, you know? And I did my job. I did my job. And that's what PG taught me, you know? And eventually I got 100 days. I remember 100 days struck me as incredible. I did the best I could to help out. I had a car, which a lot of people didn't have. I had a car with four dents on all, you know, all four corners. And I would drive people back to the mission, you know, and my car had a breathalyzer in it, you know? So I had to breathe in my car to get it started. So I had this woman's voice would say, please provide a sample, you know? And I had to like breathe to get it started. And so the guys in the mission loved that. They would laugh at me every night and say, man, that's funny. And I would think, well, I've got a card, you don't. But, you know, and that first year was tough. It was hard, you know. And if you're in that first year, I feel for you because, you know, people are talking about miracles and people are talking about the joys of sobriety. I didn't feel it. You know, I went to meetings every day and I tried my best, but it was hard. And I had a part-time job teaching, you know, in the morning, and then on the weekends, I was a children's entertainer, which I was a clown, and I just did, you know, and I wasn't so. I was far from a movie star, you know. I wasn't the star I thought I was going to be. I wasn't anything. I was a clown with a breathalyzer in my car. And I remember getting out of a gig one time and, you know, whipping my little colored wig off, and the makeup is all sweating down my face. And I put my key in the car, and the car says, "Please provide a sample." I started to cry. I was like, this is miserable. My life sucks. But I provided a sample, and I drove home, and I called my sponsor, and I called a friend in AA, and we laughed about it, and we kept going, you know, and that's what, you know, as Ron said earlier, just keep coming back, you know, and that's what I did. And I got up to that 1 year, and there we were at Norm's, me and three of my best friends wearing a tie on Saturday night, sitting at Norm's, you know, and my friend said, "How lame are we?" And we laughed because we said, this is the lamest thing we have ever done. And we were the happiest we have ever been because sobriety was working for us. I was getting a year of sobriety, and I knew everybody at Norm's. I knew all their names. I shook their hands. I was so happy, you know, and sobriety went on for me. I continued to try to be an actor, and it was hard. I remember about a year and a half into sobriety going to an audition, and I blew it. You know, I blew the audition. I could see it in the woman's face. I got in my car. I'm banging my steering wheel. I'm like, I can't do this, you know, and I called Tom B, my sponsor, and said, "Hey, you know, what can I do?" And he's, you know, he was a successful actor. He was getting jobs. And he said, "I don't have an answer for you. You know, why don't you pray about it?" And of course, that wasn't what I wanted. You know, I wanted him to say, "Hey, call my agent. We'll get you a job. We'll get this thing going." No, he said, "Pray about it." And so I started to pray about it. I, you know, I asked God to help me set aside all that I think I know and to open my mind to a new experience. You know, help me see the truth about my acting and about my life. And after a couple weeks, weird thing, you know, those little kids I was teaching began to grow on me. You know, they began to grow on me. And I remember one day my agent called me up because I had this part-time job and I was able to leave for auditions whenever I wanted, which was great, you know, but my agent called me up and said, "Hey, you know, we have an audition at 10 o'clock. And I was like, "Ooh, can we do it later?" You know, because at 10 o'clock, Tim was having a birthday party, and Tim was my best buddy at school. You know, he was a little kid, and he wanted me to be there at his party, you know? And I was like, "I can't do 10 o'clock. And my agent said, "That's 10 o'clock or nothing." And I said, "Okay, it's nothing then," you know? And I turned down the audition, and I began to realize that there was more to life. You know, these kids were everything for me. And a year later, I was in a third grade classroom with LA Unified School District as a full-time teacher. It was insane, you know, I didn't know what I was doing. The kids were all looking at me like, "What are we doing?" And I was like, "I don't know, let's figure this out." But I did it, you know, I asked my neighbor teachers, "What are you doing today? Can I do it too? How do I do this?" You know, PG taught me that. Ask people for help, talk to people, share, you know. And I remember that year and a half of like teaching full time and you know, going to the district was paying for me to get my credential, you know, so doing credentialing in the afternoon. That was a tough year. And I remember calling friends up, you know, Friday afternoon, calling people up and saying, "I want a drink, you know, I want a drink." And my friends laughing about that and saying, "Me too, man, me too. Let's go to a meeting, you know." And so we go to a meeting, we go to Friday night, and I began teaching. I taught there in LA Unified for 5 years, and I liked to travel. So I started traveling because I had some money, and I started traveling. I remember my first trip in sobriety, my first big trip in sobriety, I was going to Mexico for 2 weeks, and I wasn't going to do AA. You know, I was going to be fine for 2 weeks. I was just going to take a vacation from everything, you know, and I went to Mexico, and I remember ending up at a city that I didn't really like. with living somewhere where I wasn't really comfortable. And I was just feeling really, you know, that twist inside. And I thought, man, I need a meeting, you know? And so I asked my, you know, my person I was living with, you know, ¿Dónde está AA, you know? And she didn't know where it was. She said, try the park, you know? And I went to the park and I was like, ¿Dónde está Alcohólico Anónimos, you know? And he said, well, go that way. And I was walking down, this little kid came out with like long hair, not a kid, like 20 years old, long hair, came out and said, hey man, what do you need? You know? And I was like, I don't need anything from you. I just need Alcohólico Anónimos. And he said, soy doble A, you know? And he was about 3 weeks sober from drinking and about 6 weeks sober from drugs. And he was going to take me to a meeting, you know? And so he picked me up that evening on his moped and took me to a meeting. And it was all in Spanish, and I didn't speak Spanish at the time, but it doesn't matter, you know, because AA shares are kind of all the same, you know, you listen, things are bad, something happened, everything's better now, all right, you know, and it was great to share with them and to see that Alcoholics Anonymous works everywhere. And in my travels, I learned that there was a thing called international teachers, and I was like, wow, how do you do that, you know, and PG taught me to ask questions, to find out. I found out how to do it. I did the research. I, you know, I interviewed. I got a job in India, and I went to India, you know. And I knew in India there was AA there, and I got there, and there was AA, you know. And so I got to experience AA in India. India, the first person who got everyone sober was Harry. Harry came to New Delhi and he had some information about AA and he started getting people sober. So Harry is, and when you go to a meeting there, you have Bill, Bob, and Harry, you know, and it works there. It works in India. I moved to Dubai and I got sober in Dubai. I stayed sober. I started sponsoring people. You know, my sponsor, I remember when I was in India, the first 6 months were rough because the meetings were different. You know, people weren't sharing the way I was used to, you know, there was no structure, there was no PG. It was one guy running the whole thing. And I stopped going to meetings and it got worse, you know, and about Christmas time that year, I was miserable. I was miserable. And I come home and I talked to Keith. He was my sponsor at the time. And I said, what do I do, you know? And he says, hey, you're 7 years sober. Stop trying to get something out of the meetings. You know, you go to the meeting and you offer your sobriety, you know, you offer your sponsorship, your step work, you know, change my sobriety completely, you know. And after that, I was able to go into those meetings and I was able to talk about my sponsor and talk about my steps. And people said, hey, can you help me with those? You know, and I began to sponsor people in India and Dubai. And recently I wanted to quit teaching, so I came to Costa Rica, and we have an amazing AA group here. I met my wife, and I got married, and now I have a three-year-old girl, and it's amazing. You know, my life is incredible. I am jealous of myself, you know, how incredible life is, and it's all due to AA. You know, AA changed everything about me, And one of the things I love about AA is sponsoring people. You know, I've had, right now I'm sponsoring a guy who, you know, his wife kicked him out. And he's living here with me and I have a couple cabins on the place and he's living with me. And, you know, I had to say to him the same thing Tom B said to me that day is like, you need to make a connection to God. You know, you need to find a higher power because that is the only thing that is going to help you. And that's what's helped me, you know, this connection. Wherever I've been, I've always had a connection to a higher power, and I'm so grateful for that. You know, PG, I learned how to, I was an actor when I came into PG, you know, I was an actor, I was a star, but, I didn't really know anything about acting. I didn't know anything about performing. You know, TG taught me how to perform. You know, I went to the Mountain High and I did the skits there. I remember I did my first skit at Mountain High. I wrote this character called Literature Guy who was like an overzealous literature guy. And he would like, he had his own literature he wrote and he would sell it, you know, and he was very intense. And it was a hit, you know, the crowd loved it there at Mountain High. And I remember afterwards, I was 9 months sober at the time. I remember afterwards, Patrick S. saying to me, "Hey, that was really funny. That was good." And I remember saying to him, "Yeah, but who saw it? You know, who saw it?" And he was like, "Keep coming back, man. Keep coming back, you know," because I was like, if an agent didn't see it, if someone important didn't see me, what was the point, you know? And I learned in Pacific Group that I learned the joy of performing. And I remember Judy R was a stand-up comic at the time, and she got me into some clubs in Hollywood. And suddenly I was doing stand-up comedy in Hollywood. And every night it had nothing about who was there to see me. It was about who I could entertain in that room that night, you know? And I love how AA can work in all aspects of my life. You know, AA has transformed me completely. I recently had some real resentments against my wife. And, you know, I didn't know what to do. I was so upset that, you know, my mind goes, you know, I go to divorce, getting away, all this, you know, and I was able to call Keith, you know, and Keith was like, back to basics, you know, do a fourth step, sit down, do that fourth step, you know, and you know, at 20 years of sobriety, sometimes you forget about that. You forget, okay, there's basics to this program, you know, and I sit down and I write out that whole resentment, you know, column by column. And of course, as always happens, I get to that fourth column and see my part, you know, and it's like, oh, okay, I see my part in this, you know, and I'm able to forgive and I'm able to move on, you know, and that's the beauty of this program, is to be able to, you know, keep my side of the street clean and to, you know, forgive. My sponsee who's living in my house, you know, he's sharing about his kids are afraid, his wife is angry, you know, and we're gonna work on that fourth step. But basically I was able to tell him, you know, love is the answer. Which is crazy for me to say. You know, I could think 20 years ago when I came to AA, if someone said to me, love is the answer, I would have said, oh my God, who are you? You know, this is insane. That's not an answer to anything, but it is, you know, love God, be of service. That's what AA has taught me. That's what Pacific Group has taught me. And it works in everything. You know, I can be of service in my work. I can be of service in my house. You know, I can be of service everywhere. And I can, you know, I'm so grateful for the point of view, you know. Clancy always talked about, you know, a disease of perception. And, you know, I miss Clancy. Clancy was amazing. My Clancy, you know, he would, you know, bark at everybody. But I remember I was in the one year I did the singing, the choir before the Christmas, you know, and I decided to do that. And I was so happy one day because he was like listening to everybody. He was like, wait, who's off? And he had each person go through and say, you sing. Okay, you sing. And he had me singing, you sing. And he's like, ah, it's you. You don't sing, you know? And so he told me to mouth the words. And I was like, Clancy yelled at me. Awesome. And I mouthed the words. I did what I was told. You know, I love that man. And it's great to be a part of PG because, you know, I've been around the world and a lot of people know Clancy, you know, and I got to share about him and I got to share about, you know, what he offered to our group and what he offered to the world, you know, his love of structure and his love of sobriety. And definitely amazing. Ron mentioned Frank J. You know, I remember once I was reading the 12 traditions and 12 on the Saturday Way of Life meeting, and, you know, and I made a joke during the 12 traditions, you know, I thought it was very funny and everyone laughed. And afterwards, you know, he one-on-one said to me, "Hey, this is a serious program. People die in this program, you know, and those traditions are how we live our life, you know, and they keep us sober and sane. And it's not a joke, you know?" And at first I was like, "Hey, old man, back off." But he's right. You know, we joke a lot in the AA, but it's not a joke. You know, this is life or death. And so, you know, there's a lot of, you know, I've lost a lot of friends, you know, and we all have in PG, and we see them go, you know, so it's a beautiful program. It's a hilarious program, but it's also a deadly serious program. And, you know, I'm grateful to know that today and to be a part of that. I think I'm near the end of my time here, but I'm so grateful to be here and to see all your faces. I'm flicking through and seeing all these familiar faces and just happy to be a part of this program with you. If you're new, you're an amazing group. I know the Zoom is hard. I'm done with it. I'm done with the Zoom. We have one in-person meeting here in San Jose, and I'm so grateful for that, you know, and hopefully we'll have more, but we'll all get through this. But, you know, stay with us. Keep coming back. Thanks for being a part of my life, everybody. I love you all. Mwah. Thank you.
Sobriety is freedom from alcohol, pills, pot, anything which would affect you from the neck up. If you're a regular attendee of this meeting and would like to take a cake with us, please email our scribe, Ann P., at birthdays@pacificgroupla.org.
Hey, everybody. My name's Ann, and I'm an alcoholic.
And please email her by 6:30. Otherwise, you have to wait until the following week to get recognized. We have several birthdays tonight, and we have a special guest singing our birthday song.
Hello, Xander Alcoholic.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday now, all you AAs. Happy birthday to you. Keep coming back.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. And our birthdays are as follows. Here they come. We have David G for 1 year. His sponsor is Jerry C. We have Joel S for 1 year. His sponsor is Mitch R. We have Michael G for 2 years. His sponsor is Lewis O. We have Sam B for 3 years. His sponsor is Gabe B. We have Kathy T for 6 years. Her sponsor is Joby W. We have Marge L for 6 years. Her sponsor is Denise A. We have Veronica B for 16 years. Her sponsor is Sharon C. We have George S for 17 years. His sponsor is Jeff H. We have Yvonne S for 27 years. Her sponsor is Pat Y. We have Barbara B for 35 years. Her sponsor is Mary M. We have Conrad H for 31 years. His sponsor is Tom B. We have Jeff E for 35 years. His sponsor is Tom B. We have Lily M for 35 years. Her sponsor is Mary M. We have Tom B, who's a former secretary of our meeting for 40 years. His sponsor is Matt J. We have Marilyn S, also a former secretary for 49 years. Her sponsor is Father Tom. So we had 15 birthdays for 304 years. The average is 20.26 years per birthday. Happy birthday, all of our recipients. We have a custom at the Pacific Group of donating $1 for each candle on our birthday cakes. At the end of the year, this candle money is our contribution to AA organizations worldwide. If you'd like to participate in this custom, please email our treasurer, Betty H., at treasurer@pacificgroupla.org. Underneath special announcements,